If you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
It's society. They work for each other, they pay each other, they buy houses, they get married, make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
I can't wait for the episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants team up, and they overpower the host, and they share the money.
The message of Occupy Wall Street is I would prefer not to play the existing game.
We are a socialist party and there are social solutions to the problems.
Communal lifestyles, I don't know about that.
No one can tell me what to do.
Wow, you're a real anarchist.
And now we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
No words for you puppets of the West. Communism forever.
God, those communists are amazing.
Welcome to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. That music means this is serious news time. Serious news. I am your host, Dan Platt. This is your leftist reading hour for the week, bringing you radical politics for promoting a commons economy and direct democracy for a post-capitalist world and locality. This show represents socialism, anarchism, and ecology. Those are the three lefts, and this is the Three Left Show. I'm in pretty good mood right now. Don't know why. Maybe it's because I'm in staycation mode. The summer's winding down for most, but my vacation is upcoming. That'll be mid-September. That'll be my birthday time. But otherwise, so right now, I had an idea last year where we have a local, through the library, a local TV station. Public access is the word I wanted. And why not? And I kind of wanted to expand the YouTube, but at least try to. So why not make YouTube videos where I make a kind of, like, the Cracked news show, some more news, roadies, showdy. But just more serious, actually. I mean, he's pretty serious, too. Do something like that, but light, smaller, the bite-sized stories, the smaller, shorter stories that only take 5 minutes to read don't really make for the right format for this, the general show, where I kind of cover six stories if I'm on my own, which I am this week with Mike. He has a birthday engagement. So let's start with an editorial to just kick things off. Not to make light of, okay, on the macro scale, news in our country looks pretty bad. And it is. Large institutions are probably, to take a anarchistic and primitivist tone, the bane of humanity's existence. Small is beautiful. Things should get smaller, or more decentralized, at the very least, if we're going to have large political bodies, which ensure more peace and less competition amongst various groups. The ability to make deals, the ability to reach compromises. These are the promises of our liberal democracy, which have not been able to deliver, mostly because those values are in conflict with things like the profit motive, market distribution, the kind of things that any anti-capitalist critique can point out the problems with. I won't be doing a lot of that this episode. This is more exploring the various facets of, let's see, relationship stories, union starting stories, people starting unions, new ones in the tech sector, and other social services, which did not exist before, not just because, hey, it's not like we have industry anymore, right? So the good news is never going to be big news. It's never going to be on the national level. It's not going to be in the nightly news. Maybe in the local news, you'll have fluff stories, not really substantially good news. Kind of more of a, in fact, this is something that Some More News, trademark, has pointed out. You did a pretty good episode, and I guess I'll put a link to that in the about fluff stories, about how it's part of capitalist propaganda to do fluff stories about, say, someone receiving charity. They had a tragedy struck or a personal crisis, usually caused by the fact that, say, we don't have universal health care, we don't have universal services or housing or any actual meeting of basic needs in this country. The very fact that, like, America is very unique in that we have this thing called evictions. that where you can't pay rent and then the police come and throw you out or you're forced to leave. This is something that most other countries, at least social democracies, do not have because they have public housing. They have somewhere else you can physically move to, or there are more stringent housing rights. How do they get these rights? They fought for them. There was almost revolution, there was general strikes, and that was the compromise to ensure that evictions wouldn't happen in the future. We had general strikes in America, but then there was the early compromise of the New Deal, and then there was a kind of almost a counter coup of sorts, and the right fought back, and as much as especially when that base that agitated then kind of got absorbed into the new middle class. Let's get to my purpose. This is from McSweeney's with the Internet Tendency. This is a humor site. You'll get that from this. So this story is called and published earlier in the year when Bernie Sanders was starting to win primaries. Oh boy, did that feel like a lifetime ago? It's called America Must Not Become Socialist Lest We Abandon What Makes Our Country Awful. Written by Matthew Brian Cohen. Let's get right off the bat. This is a socialist show, proudly, but it's also We Must Stop It. According to a recent Gallup poll, the majority of Democrats have a positive view of socialism. With the rise of Bernie Sanders as a clear and obvious frontrunner of the Democratic nomination, at least in popular support, it seems Americans are starting to warm to the idea of a more socialist America. But America must never become socialist, lest we abandon what makes our country awful. If America embraces Venezuelan-style socialism, a term we all know the meaning of that I will refuse to explain, make no mistake, America would no longer be the land of the free that all of us wealthy white people know and love. Just take a second and think about it. Healthcare that woefully lags behind the rest of the world, crumbling infrastructure, a corrupt and incompetent electoral process. And now stop thinking about America and start thinking about what it's like in Venezuela. Under socialism, Americans might have to ration their medicine, and not just their insulin, like we currently do. Americans will be forced to spend hours waiting in long lines at a hospital instead of spending that time with your family huddled around the phone with a Kaiser Permanente customer service rep as you try to understand why you were billed $3,000 for an x-ray. Americans need to understand that a socialist government, while sounding good in theory, would ultimately result in totalitarianism. Yes, a socialist government could use its power to spy on citizens, listening to their phone conversations, reading their emails, even watching them through their laptop cameras. In America, our intelligence agencies can only do those things if they lie to Congress about it first. Our founding fathers created this illusion of checks and balances to keep every facet of our government equally unaccountable. If that feels undemocratic or authoritarian to you, know that capitalism allows for private tech companies like Amazon, Google, Facebook, Google, Apple, Microsoft to sell you the home assistants that make our surveillance state function. A socialist government would merely invade your privacy, foregoing all that juicy profit-making. The American free market creates competition, and competition pushes these tax-dodging corporations to be better so they can do worse by you, the public. And as we all know, private industry is far better at infringing upon your rights than the government. A socialist government just can't effectively govern this way. One only needs to look at Venezuela, the only socialist country I can think of. In socialist Venezuela, there is a question about who the rightful president is. Is it the man the people elected, or is it the puppet our government is desperately trying to install? Who can tell? It's total chaos brought on by the decades of American imperialism down in socialist Venezuela. Luckily, in America, we know exactly who our president is. It's the man who just declared innocent in a sham trial with no witness and a jury predisposed to his acquittal. No confusion, no instability. The president is a rapist reality TV show host. And yes, while it may be concerning that the Trump man is in lockstep with the legislative branch that was intended to limit his power, he is not a king. The ever-expanding scope of the executive branch ensures that he has far more power than any 18th century monarch could ever dream of, exactly as our founding fathers intended. You will not find freedom in a socialist country. No, sir. And it's not, and it's our freedoms that make America great. By no rational account, we are the freest country in history. We have armies all over the world losing wars every day to defend those freedoms. the freedom for your landlord to charge you whatever they want, the freedom to pay back your exorbitant student loans over however many decades you decide, the freedom to walk into a grocery store and select one of the 100 different brands of cereal made by 2 global conglomerates, the freedom to vote for whichever candidate the DNC wants you to. If the iPhone app their idiot stepson designed somehow manages to function, and that's the last freedom, the right to participate in our democracy, that's the most important. In America, we believe that anyone with money can participate in our corrupt political process. $1 billion equals one vote, no matter who you are. So young people, people of color, women, the LGBTQ rainbow, the working class, and anyone else in the overwhelming majority who are considering a vote for Sanders, mark my words, America is not and never will be a socialist country. We will become Nazis before we ever allow that. And that is the end of that section. And certainly, for as far as the ruling class and the DNC is concerned, they did do whatever it takes to make sure that America does not become even an iota more left-wing. Move that needle towards social democracy. Asked individually, everyone supports social democratic policies, you know, the universal health care, the housing, and so on. But voter suppression is real, all right? Not voter fraud, voter suppression, which comes in the form of closing voting sites. And in the case of, well, during a pandemic, A, choosing to have the, continuing to have the primaries, knowing full well that fewer people will be able to vote, not to mention the danger in allowing the in-person voting to happen and not having the mail-in system set up. Now, on the local level here in Albany, we did have mail-in voting for our school elections, and they found that more people voted than ever before. And it's not because there were fake ballots. No. It was just that more people were actually just able to send in their vote. Since that was the norm, and dropping it off at your leisure at, say, the district office, which is downtown, and for me, it's a few blocks away. Okay, this one kind of stands alone because it is a insurrectionary story. And I suppose as being on a community radio station under FCC guidelines, I'll just cover my butt and say that I do not endorse any crime whatsoever. This is crime. And crime is bad. Crime is bad, okay? This is from Anarchists Worldwide. It's worldwide because this story comes from France. In France, an arson attack has been committed against luxury yachts in Marseille. That's on the southern coast, if you didn't know. About 40 boats were deliberately set on fire during the night of Monday the 16th. This is last year in December, and Tuesday the 17th at the port in La Queste in Marseille. This is the second incendiary attack against the rich in Marseille in a few months. The fire started at around 11 p.m. in one of the racks of the dry dock, Port West Marseille. West is west. Unless you thought I said west, it's west. Anyway, in 52, marine firefighters mobilized to fight the flames until 6 a.m. Unfortunately, they managed to stop the flame spreading to the boats stored one above the other. They were stacked double deck. They were double deck style. Two hooded individuals are spotted in video surveillance images. Ooh, spooky. It should be noted that the port is enclosed and supervised by a guard. This is the second time in a few months that boats in dry dock have been burned in Marseille. On May 18th, two hooded men were filmed setting fire to a number of boats of Balleur at the Point Rouge on the other side of Marseille. 7 months later, the guys still haven't been found, confided the manager of a boat garage. This Tuesday, the police consider it far too soon to know whether the two fires are linked. Just a piece, a little news scrap there. Let me just throw out an advertisement. Not really an advertisement because it's all kind of free and accessible, but if you internet browse and you want a little bit of your humanity and sanity back, I suggest switching your browser to Mozilla Firefox. There you have various add-ons like Adblocker, Script Blocker, Ghostly, which blocks trackers, and more that allowed you to kind of get the advertising out of your face. My friends mentioned that, you know, and whenever I use YouTube on my phone, which does not have these options, I get to see Trump ads and or something like that. And it's, annoying. And if it wasn't just once a while, in my case, I understand how it would add to people's stress. So the next three stories are more about relationships, child rearing, or just kind of reproductive rights, actually, general rubric. So, but here's one of those stories that would have right-wingers or even moderates going, I don't know how to feel about that. It's kind of cringy. But it's also kind of one of those, like, this is the future that liberals want. And we would respond as left-wingers, don't threaten us with a good time, please. Same goes when Trump, say, calls Biden, or rather any Republican calls a Democrat a radical socialist, that they're actually being pulled to the left by, say, the BLM movement or any such thing, because that's not true at all. In fact, the opposite is happening. They run from us. They make sure that they're distanced, and we're not actually listened to. The best that they do is try to placate us, and that perhaps makes them look weak, and that they have bowed to the demands of the mob. But please do not mistake symbolism for actual change. It's a bit longer, but it'll be quick and breezy. They're single, they're straight, they're friends, and they're having a baby. You want a child, you don't want to do it alone. But what do? For an increasing number of women, the answer is raising a kid with their BFF. Oh, so they're not lesbians. Okay, not a romantic or sexual relationship. And maybe they're using, we'll look into the details. But in the context of, let's see, more single women or all of us, including myself, not marrying, getting married later. Some of us are just getting our lives on track as far as having a steady job that, say, can provide us the basic necessities without subsidy or living with one's parents, let's say, or some kind of communive arrangement of some type where we're just kind of hustling, or we hustle and then we exploit everyone around us to make sure that we have the necessary income to pay rent and all the other taxes of sorts. Sarah and Kay's first child arrived on their doorstep in Southern Ontario, Canadians, just 4 days ago. Registered as foster parents, the pair received a call informing them that their baby needed home. Okay, they're adopting. They're adopting. Okay. So it's not a freak of nature bidding in God's face, nature degeneracy kind of thing. But it's a non-romantic couple. I think that's the new part here, that this is their platonic friends that are adopting a baby. Did they want her or not? Days later, a social worker arrived with the infant and a brown paper bag full of the essentials. And then, after giving a confidence-boosting smile, she walked out the door. Sarah and Kay turned their attention to the baby girl suddenly lying in the middle of the carpet. Now, this is essentialized. I'm sure they actually went through long preparation. Sarah and Kay aren't a couple. They're best friends who decided to co-parent their children in a shared home. Both in the early 30s, Sarah and Kay met as first-year college roommates 15 years ago and have lived together ever since. They traveled to Europe, adopted a dog. See, you always adopt a dog before a kid. Kay, and whose parents live overseas, considers herself an unofficial sibling in Sarah's big, welcoming family. When the two women were together, giggles punctuate their speech, and it's easy to picture them gossiping through the night in a shared dorm room. A few years ago, Sarah and Kay, who are both straight, felt called by their Christian faith to help others and wondered, why not welcome children into their home? Sarah has been running a daycare. Kay works in the healthcare industry, and things with the dog were going well. They could take care of the dog, so they felt confident they could handle foster parenting. By the way, I have not actually read this before. I didn't know there was a religious angle. But hey, if you're religious, hey, then this makes this even more positive, right? But thus, it's like it's a contradiction with, say, the more orthodox conservative religiosity of parents need to be a man and a woman, and they need to be married, and it needs to be, you know, they need to make the child. But there's enough orphans out there. And so, yeah, they're actually practicing their religion quite well. Soon, the two friends couldn't imagine life without children. Sarah and Kay filed for adoption and, in late 2018, won a landmark ruling in Canadian court that gave them equal rights as platonic partners to adopt the two children. So there's where the politics come in. They had to fight a court case. No, duh. And that's how we became a family. After all, if two men or married or people in a civil union can adopt children, why not two platonic friends? They're two consenting adults who are responsible and da-da-da. So many women have long given up the fantasy of having it all in a capitalist economy, but that's another level up of wokeness. Plenty of others still want a family and don't particularly want to do it alone, and if you're ready to welcome a baby but swiping on dating apps is getting you nowhere, there just aren't a lot of great choices. That's why an increasing number of women are expanding their options by forming families with friends and sisters to raise children as co-parents and create what looks like conventional family life. Nuclear-like unit headed by two women. Now, a nuclear family, of course, we can discuss how mythical that is, how what a minority it was. It was just kind of propagated on TV as being what normal was. Dole out advice, pick up the slack, keep each other sane, and don't need to be nagged into doing so 50% of the child rearing and chores. Oh, equality. Love it. This kind of arrangement has the potential to flourish as marriage rates have declined across the U.S. 42% of adults, but this is in Canada, so maybe we need a separate court case here. Let's see, 42% of adult Americans now live without a spouse or partner, myself included. For adults under 35, that's me, that number rises to 61%. For decades, the narrative associated with non-partnered women who wanted to have a baby was single parents by choice. According to 2017 data from the Pew Research Center, 21% of children in the United States, or 1 in 5, now live with a solo mother, up from 12% in 1968. So I'll repeat that again. It's 21% now, or at least few years ago when the numbers were taken, which is almost double from 50 years ago. 60 now, I guess. They reputed, the Pew report also found that 65% of American children live with two married parents, but that's down from 85%. A whole 20% dip in the last 60 years. Oh, there is a pervasive myth that women who delay childbirth are careerists, more interested in climbing the corporate ladder and selling a crying infant. Now, of course, this assumes that a majority of workers are in corporate firms and they're able to climb, that there is this social mobility if you sacrifice family life. But this is a minority, and this is, you know, it's a narrative for professionals, right? As far as the middle class goes, professionals are all that is left. Also, to use a Marxist term, professional managerial class. So there is a class, talk about it class-wise, and it conclude people of all races, creeds, and colors, but of varying amounts, which are not in parity to the general population. But according to a 2018 study by D. Morfort University in UK, primary reason women freeze their eggs is to avoid panic parenting because they haven't found yet the right partner. I saw a Law & Order episode that had this as a subplot. No, it wasn't the subplot. It was the plot. Was that in the aughts? It was when it was a new technology, as Law & Order does. As we're flooded with an expanding glossary of modern dating indignities, like ghosting, when someone you're dating suddenly disappears, benching, when you're someone's backup choice, and stashing, when you're in a relationship but your partner refuses to introduce you to their friends, perhaps it should come as no surprise that women are looking for alternatives when it comes to creating a family. Sex and the City was just the beginning. These women are finding fulfillment through a pact that feels both revolutionary and like a total no-brainer. Because isn't that the real revolution when we just do what's sensible and needed? Co-mom relationships might be platonic, but they are unmistakably love stories. For some, the arrangement is a matter of circumstance, while others come to co-parenting quite deliberately. Regardless, all of these women have decided to draw an expanded boundary around the idea of family, and they're finding fulfillment through a pact. Women banding together to raise children neither new nor rare. See kibbutz life, that's Jewish communes, so it's commune life. TV's circa mid-1980s, Kate and Ally, I'm sure that was for laughs. But formal co-parenting arrangements, which are less common, have been increasingly visible in the zeitgeist of late. Playing House, the USA Network sitcom that ran for 3 seasons until 2017, portrays 2 best friends who move in together after one gets pregnant so they can raise the baby together. Co-abode, a nationwide housing matching network, was launched in 06, fitting, when the housing market crashed, to bring together single mothers looking to split expenses and child-rearing duties. It formerly ran a Facebook page that was filled with requests from Seattle to Pittsburgh. Statistics about platonic co-parenting are scarce, but in 2017, research commissioned by Family Story, I don't know who funds them, found that 58%, and now, of course, if I had Mike in here, I would ask him to look that up, found that 58% of unmarried mothers would consider raising a child with someone who is not a romantic partner. It's more than half. Interest in platonic options is growing, and by the way, that I'd include myself if I was asked that question. And there was now an increasing number of social networks for singles looking for co-parenting arrangements, including familybydesign.com and coparentmatch.com. Some sites like modfamily.com offer a matchmaking function for prospective co-parents, so it's kind of a little small cottage industry. Esther Perel, a psychotherapist practicing in New York City and the host of the popular couples therapy podcast, Where Should We Begin?, told Marie Claire she predicts in the next 25 years a rise of friendship parenting between adults who want to co-parent without being a singular committed relationship. We often think of relationships between two people, but in the future, I'd like to see more consideration of relationships between communities, groups, and countries. Cross borders. Because borders, not real, baby. Sometimes I wonder what things would be like if I were doing this with a husband, but then I look at my friends who are married, and I know it's not perfect over there either, says Lauren Brim, a 36-year-old sex coach in L.A., who wrote about her experiences raising a now 4-year-old with a straight male friend in her 2016 book, The New American Family, Modern Stories of Family Formation in the 21st Century. 21st Century! You can wander the earth looking for Mr. Right for a long time and now find him. And not find him. I'm right here. Brim says she was inspired in part by a recently divorced friend who appeared to be having more fun than most of her married friends. And this is one of those things that's like, well, marriage isn't really on my priority list. Revolution is first, baby. For half the week, it would be kids' world with homework and dance parties in the living room, and then the other half would be R-rated movies and whiskey at the bar. I'm skipping to the end here. Many of these co-parenting arrangements might appear unconventional, but they're fundamentally just two adults raising kids together. Sarah and Kay didn't set out to challenge the status quo, and their arrangement might even be viewed as somewhat traditional. It is two adults, right? Sarah stays at home with the kids, and Kay works full-time. I see. Trad wife. But not at all. Kay does the dishes. Sarah cuts the grass. So they share all the chores, though. They split sleep training duties because they have the baby. 30 years ago, it was a mom and a dad, and that was all you heard about. Sarah says, we just don't look at things in a cookie-cutter way anymore. There are so many different ways to raise kids. These women are the mothers to each other's children, the partners who steer each other through life and myriad decisions, and the companions who provide a strong sense of home. In other words, a family. And this article appeared in the February 2020 issue of Marie Claire. So I guess they're a monthly publication mag. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Okay, a number of thoughts from this is kind of how, like I kind of half said before, the revolution is kind of in doing what's necessary. The material conditions, meaning the way things are, meaning with us millennials growing up with the recession, with strained incomes, not being paid what we're worth, but let's say we are being paid what we are worth. And of course, it's not enough. It's not enough to raise a family or buy a house on. We're just treading water. And so we kind of need to do things communally together and not worry about the relationships. Okay, so that's one side. The need to share responsibilities, which is just as human nature as you can get. Or rather, it's part of being human. The other side of it is, okay, but the relationship structure of pairing up with, you know, as with sexual partners seems to be waning. Well, let's say we've got women's libs, so you're not dependent on one partner to get sex or sexual gratification. There's the dating apps, the creation of, so the technology that created our modern world, computers, bureaucratic algorithms, and so on, the rule sets, that's been put on our, invaded all of our social lives, and thus it's kind of, you could say it's eroding old institutions, being disruptive. And this is all like this is kind of fated to be. You know, if we're going to have computers for, you know, to launch the space shuttle and do the military stuff and then home accounting, we're also going to have it for dating, and it would kind of quote unquote mess things up. It would create these kind of new social mores and processes like the ghosting, the stacking, the stashing. These are all things that are more possible now because of these technologies. Maybe they were likely always happening before. I mean, they appeared in sitcoms and all kinds of other things, media. But it's way pervasive. And because of social media, we're all aware of these practices. Maybe that's the problem. It was always happening, but now it's all uncovered. Things are more honest. Like, we're able to see what the problems are. And it's like, well, rather than we can deal with them by basically saying, we're not putting up with this, we're just going to abstain, say no, or I'm not going to continue with this dumb dating game thing that most of our, you know, parents or whatever had to suffer through, or as the divorce rate would show, half of them don't work. So why go through the rigmarole of weddings and all this other stuff, marriage as this institution, if half of it if it fails half the time? So there's a lot of different thoughts and attitudes that are bouncing around that I hold myself. An attack on monogamy further, classical monogamy, have a story from Nicole. I'm trying to read the subtitle, and it's like cocktails and conversations. So again, this is more of a lifestyle magazine. And that's the thing about like the news jam format here. I'm not taking from the standard leftist magazines and stuff. It's just stuff that kind of overlaps with like what's the societal change happening that isn't just in leftist politics circles, because you can get stuck in there in the weeds, and that's kind of what we've been covering with Mike on this program the last few weeks, and we'll get to have part three next time. And then there's another one where I'm going to cover different strategies argued about, but otherwise the children of Will Smith. So I don't know all the details, but I assume from what I was seeing that Will Smith was in like an open relationship, or he thought he was, or he lied about it. I don't know. Was it just a standard, like, I was cheating on my wife thing? And he cried. I don't know what the actual details were, but his children are woke as hell. Really radical. Like, Jaden, anti-capitalist politics. He made like a cartoon. I thought it was like great satire. It was really punchy. Like, it did not make any bones. Like, oh yeah, I'm not just like half making fun of capitalism. I am making fun of capitalism. I am calling out the contradictions. Interesting stuff. Called Neo-Yokio. It got bashed quite a lot from anime fans because it isn't really an anime. But, nerd shit. Let's see. Okay, so this is Willow Smith. You know, the sister. Willow had a short music career because, hey, when you're a rich kid, you can do whatever you want. That's class thing. But that's the thing about being woke and rich. Like, they're really aware of everything they have, and they kind of do positive things, or they use the platform to kind of be like more than just being instigators. Okay, Willow Smith on polyamory and loving both men and women equally. So, you know, bye too. My last relationship was fueled, and by the way, you know, bi-ness is something that's been really trodden upon in the lesbian and gay community. Like, it's like, you gotta be one or the other. You're not helping the cause by being bi. Like, they would actually, like, have these attitudes. So being bi in the LGBTQ is, you know, to not be the L or the G, each letter added has to actually fight to justify their inclusion in that community, and also how they are part of the cause. They are part of expanding the possibilities. And, well, not really the possibilities, what's possible, but what is. Because it's a recognition of what is. That there are people who are bi. There are people who are trans. They have always been there. My last relationship was fueled by jealousy and blind rage, checking each other's phones and fighting about our findings, angry at social media interactions, and flirty onlookers alike. It took me a while to realize that we're in love. We were in possession of one another, totally and completely. Someone told me once that if you love a flower, you shouldn't pick it up, because if you pick it up, it dies, and can no longer be the object of your affection. And I think the same applies to relationships. The pressure of monogamy can bring to light a number of insecurities that may have been previously hidden and cause you to resent the person you once fell so deeply in love with. Yesterday, on the latest episode of Red Table Talk, I guess a podcast, 18-year-old Willow Smith kept it a buck about how... And that's a phrase I'm not familiar with. Kept it a buck. Maybe it's a misspelling. About how she really feels about monogamy and challenged us to see it differently. I would too. Because whenever, like, on TV, growing up, tons of stories, most stories and conflict and sitcoms and stuff were all about, like, they weren't just about cheating. About or being insecure, afraid that your partner is cheating. And I'm like, why put up with that? Why not make an agreement for an open relationship? Why not share love? Is love so finite that it must be hoarded? Now, I did make the point that love is kind of a finite political resource. But then, it needs to have a political solution. It's not solved with these personal, like, I'm on my own, I have to have control over my partner. Willow is officially legal, and she's not... No longer jailbait. Oh, jeez. Anyway. And she's no longer the whip my hair pop star that we knew in 2010. And she was like 11. Oof. And she made that abundantly clear when she expressed her views on sexuality. I love men and women equally, and so I should definitely want one man, one woman. I feel like I could be polyfidelius with those two people. She has the freedom to do that. Needless to say, both Jada and Anne-Marie had their pearls clutched. But young Willow was making pretty solid points. Willow noted that because divorce rates are so high, it suggests that there is something left to be desired when it comes to traditional relationship structures in the modern age. Look at that. Using structural analysis. She expressed that polyamory would probably be more common if couples could let go of their own fear of losing ownership of their partners. Quoting her, "This is the scariest thought that people shy away from. It's the feeling... of feeling like the person that you love is falling in love with someone else. And that insecurity and fear just eats us alive. I've never been good at sharing. I'll have to be the first one to help you get your own. What's mine is mine. When you dig deeper into this way of thinking, you have to wonder, does this extend to people too? Of course it does. My ex was my man, and I was his girl. We got so wrapped up in this idea that we forgot people... are not trophies to be earned, owned, or placed in a cabinet for display, and thinking of them in this way only leads to jealousy, insecurity, and ultimately the ends of those relationships, violently or otherwise. Without trust, honesty, and transparency, no relationship, whether it be a couple, throuple, or a quadruple, will be successful," she explained. These are also called polycules, like a molecule, because there's like chemical bonding. It's like, oh, they have chemistry, chemical bonding. But that insecurity and fear is something that we must need to overcome and something that we need to evolve out of and transmute. Transmute. And that into something new and different can actually be helpful and make us love more and more freely. According to Willow, just being a thought leader here, according to Willow, societal pressures to be one thing to one person cannot be only be detrimental to our self-esteem, but oppressive to who we have made who we were made to be as human beings. Monogamy, I feel, actually inhibits you from learning those skills of evolving past those feelings of insecurity and jealousy. Now, these quotes from Willow Smith do not have to come from Willow Smith. Any therapist could say these things. But they're not being interviewed on talk shows. Unless they write like some book that gets a lot of press. But that doesn't happen often. If it happens at all. Maybe it's did Oprah's book club do this? No, they actually kind of come at things very conservatively, from what I see. So Willow is just being a mouthpiece for this way of thinking, and so she has a platform and she's using it, which is why it's nice to have these kind of radical children. Kids are all right, even though, you know, she's a very rich kid. But hey, it means that she has the ability to do these things. I'm not saying just because you're not happy in your relationship, because that's the difference. Like, she has, you know, the rich have the freedom to experiment with their relationships. I mean, if you're stuck, you're in poverty, you kind of have to do things the conservative way, because if you don't, you get punished twofold. You get punished for being poor, and you get punished for bucking what is expected of you, which is to be conservative. That is what I see in my communities, or the communities that I abut and I interact with. So I'm not in them, but when I interact with them, I overlap with them sometimes, and I see these conservative mores. They're instilled by fear that their members of the community enforce these values, the values of monogamy, because see, it looks like, as far as when the powers that be, like Reagan, make all the problems of the black community, it's not racism, it's single motherhood. And then everyone believes that, or everyone sort of believes that, and because the president's saying it, and it's repeated 100 other times, we're all kind of convinced of that. And you got to break the conditioning if you're going to be better. Because otherwise, we're stuck in monogamy. And in my neighborhood, there's a car with cheater, and the window's smashed out, with cheater spray paint on the side of it. Like, that's people being stuck in the poverty trap. That's people stuck in conservative values, and it holds them back. Because then people aren't cooperating, because they got to own each other. They got to ensure that their security is based on having a man, be their man, and vice versa. Men need women who are around, and they're not being loose and having their own lives. Back to Willow. I'm not saying just because you're not happy in your relationship, you should go out and open your marriage to other partners. But I do think Willow was wise beyond her years when it comes to making transparency a priority in your relationship. Part of loving someone means being whole enough to not get intimidated when your waitress giggles a little too hard at his jokes or when he likes a picture on Instagram. And if you're like Willow, who's emotionally secure enough to manage her love, and she's also financially secure, that doesn't hurt. Who's emotionally secure enough to manage her love, but of course, hell, there are plenty of rich people who are the most emotionally immature people on the planet. Our president is Exhibit A. To manage her love for not one, but two or three people, who's to say you're wrong? Just because you're married doesn't mean you suddenly let go of all the wants, needs, and desires you had before you jumped the broom. Don't know that expression either, but whatever. It just means that you have to be mature and honest enough to talk about them with your partner. And there's a full episode of the podcast when I guess the interview with Willow Smith. Okay, this is from The Friendly Atheist. Now, if I've mentioned it, before. My first spot of activism and community was the New Atheist Movement. So, anyway. Friendly Atheist. So this is from, but this is not about well, it is from atheism. So how do we fight for secularism in a country where the religious right or the orthodox religious, okay? This isn't just religion bashing. I don't do that anymore. I didn't even do it when I was a new atheist. I was always kind of like, is this really the best way we can use our energy bashing religion? Isn't there more? Like, aren't we fighting dogma? Aren't we just trying to fight biased thinking? And, you know, you learn about structures and how biased thinking comes from material conditions. How, you know, the rich think they're the hot stuff because they're rich. And the poor think they're worthless because they're poor. And dogmas and ideology is created around that. So you fight for religious rights. The best way to fight for the rights of atheists or the rights of secularists, more importantly, people who want religion and religious rules and Bible rules and the values of conservatives to be imposed on everyone, because that is a type of tyranny, theocracy. To fight theocracy, you, as far as all the court decisions are concerned, you need to be a religion to have standing to challenge, let's say, back in the culture war days of the aughts, whether it be the Christmas setups, monuments that are supposed to represent all of the public but are explicitly crosses. So it's like, well, this monument for all of us just seems to be for Christians, and so I'm not included. And if I'm not included, then am I a valued member of society? And as far as my neighbors are concerned, I'm not. Those are the kind of results. What has grown out of the New Atheist Movement, and as far as I'm concerned, the real active part of it that's still kind of doing the work, since there were a bunch of court rulings that kind of stopped the regular kind of ACLU lawsuits, and of course activism through lawsuits, just seeing how like effective that was. Like it wasn't really turning public opinion towards us as much as more as just asserting our own existence, which of course is what a lot of activism is about. But anyway, what was set up was a nonprofit called the Satanic Temple. They're atheists, but they are filed as a legal entity that is a religion, a church, so that they have standing in various legal arenas. One of them is abortion rights. Over the last 20 years, abortion rights have been eroded incredibly much, to the point where there's only a handful of states you can really have access anymore. Planned Parenthood's been defunded, but even before that, there were the states that would, conservative or Republican-run states. I'm not good at giving the whole summary because it's quite a lot of information, but I think if you're paying half attention, you know that abortion rights, the ability, the access to abortion. See, you can have the right to an abortion, but if the state limits the access to it to where only there's one clinic that will do them, if they're late stage or even early stage, then if you don't have access, you don't have a right to it. So to protect, to fight back, and even if it's just symbolically, Satanic Temple now has created a kind of process for doing a satanic abortion, which are in fact protected by religious liberty laws. Because in curtailing various liberties and access for people, whether it be to abortions or rather contraception even, as you know, in vaccines and all that, like religious liberty has been invoked. And religious liberty laws have been passed in Republican states to allow people to say no to others, to deny them access. To say, you're not welcome here. We're going to segregate the wholesome Christians from the godless / degenerate population who are going to be basically second-rate citizens because they're not going to have access to what they need. Several years ago, the Satanic Temple argued in court that one of their members in Missouri, didn't need to abide by the state's 72-hour waiting period, one of the many things that, you know, restrict access, the 72-hour, 3-day waiting period for abortions because it violated her belief that one's body is inviolable, subject to one's own will alone. That lawsuit was ultimately unsuccessful in part because she was no longer pregnant when the judge issued a ruling. They tried a similar tactic in 2019, last year, this time with an anonymous plaintiff, whose own pregnancy timeline wouldn't be an issue, but that didn't work either. So, they're seeing what sticks. The court said that whatever obstacles there were to obtaining an abortion in Missouri, women could still theoretically get them, and this plaintiff wasn't singled out because she was a Satanist. So a lawsuit based on religious discrimination was a no-go. So they're taking the opposite track. That's why today the Satanic Temple is laying the groundwork for future battles over abortion. They're announcing that all first trimester abortions must be exempt from state regulations that hinder access to the procedure because such hurdles violate 2 of their 7 fundamental tenets regarding bodily autonomy and adherence to best scientific practice. They're basically using the Hobby Lobby Supreme Court decision, which an evangelical business owner used to prevent insurance providers from covering his employees' birth control, to defend a woman's right to choose. How does that work? The Satanists say the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, passed by Congress, both houses, both parties, prohibits the government from interfering with someone's religious practices, unless there's a really good reason. Most states have their own versions of this law as well. By saying abortions in the first trimester are a religious ritual for their members, any states that have their own religious freedom laws, and most anti-abortion states do have them, would theoretically have to show why their medically unnecessary restrictions should override the Satanists' religious freedom. It's using their own logic against them, you see. TST's reproductive rights spokesperson Jane Essex notes, many states have laws that interfere with our members' ability to practice their religious beliefs. This is the way they frame it. No Christian would accept a mandatory waiting period before they can partake in communion. No Christian would tolerate a law that insists that state counseling is necessary before anyone can be baptized. Our members are justly entitled to religious liberty in order to practice our rituals as well. So, atheists make this religious institution so that they can actually get equal treatment, because as far as the law and the First Amendment's concerned, being a religion is what is required, apparently, to have equal rights. Today's announcement isn't just a press release either. The Satanic Temple is fully laying out what its abortion rituals look like. Here, for example, is what members would have to do before surgical abortions. And it's written in the type of text. Prior to receiving any anesthetic or sedation, look at your reflection and be reminded of your personhood and your responsibility to yourself. Focus on your intent. Take deep breaths and make yourself comfortable. When you are ready, say the third tenet and fifth tenet aloud. You may now undergo the surgery. After the surgery is completed and any anesthetic has worn off, return to your reflection and recite your personal affirmation. Feel doubts dissipating and your confidence growing as you have just undertaken a decision that affirms your autonomy and free will. The religious abortion ritual is now complete. And it's interesting to point out that in these mechanistic procedures of our lives, that we should create rituals around them to meditate, to reflect, and maybe reflect on what kind of bullcrap happens around us. The Satanists also offer members a template letter they can give officials if they want to take advantage of the religious exemption. This part is just a chef's kiss. So just making clear, if all your red flags are going off, know that the Satanic Temple are atheists. They're really secularists who want to enforce secular, rather, not force, provide space for secular values, separation of church and state, which have been eroded quite a lot over the last few decades, especially since 2000. And many culture war issues have been fought over it. And it always feels like, especially now that there is kind of this public recognition of being okay, at least half of the country okay with atheism or agnosticism. It's not as feared. We're not all pedophiles or seen, at least in the general public, anymore, at least not as much. But as far as legal rights and political power, we're still where we were back in 06. If anything, it's gotten worse. So kind of what's left is to kind of fight on the playing field that the courts have provided, which is, well, if you're going to make an argument for equality, you have to do it as a religion. So atheists founded a religion, and they call it the Satanic Temple. And they use all of the symbolism of Satanism and Baphomet, and it's all pretty punk, got that cool emo aesthetic, and whatnot. Picking up where I left off, the chef's kiss of having an official letter template to ask for religious exemptions to allow you to have an unburdened abortion. Because the abortive act is intrinsically linked to the religious right, R-I-T-E, a burden on the act is a burden on the right. State law implements some or all of the following generally applicable burdens on getting an abortion. Each of these substantially interfere with my religious beliefs and practices. This is the text of the letter. This includes mandatory waiting periods, requirements that practitioners withhold certain medical information, compulsory counseling prior to an abortion, required reading material, medically unnecessary sonograms, mandatory listening to the fetal heartbeat, burial or cremation of fetal remains. Based on the foregoing, I demand a religious exemption to these generally applicable restrictions. This is the friendly atheist, the blogger, writing. I asked Carolyn Mala Corbin, a professor of law at the University of Miami, who has written extensively on church-state separation, what she thought about this strategy. She told me it should work in theory, since these religious freedom laws are meant to protect all religions and not just the popular ones. But she added that there may be two problems. One, a patient would have to establish that the abortion ritual is a sincere religious practice, and a court may reject that claim. After all, the member of the Satanic Temple is arguing that an abortion is akin to a sacrament. A hostile court may also conclude that beliefs about autonomy and science, while sincere, are secular rather than religious, though it would be wading into murky territory by declaring that sincere beliefs are not religious, as courts are generally wary of drawing a line between religious beliefs and non-religious beliefs. What are the differences then? Number two, a patient would have to show that the abortion restrictions substantially burden their practice, their access, which they do, especially for teens and those who are younger. Well, after Hobby Lobby, courts are supposed to be deferential to religious objectors' claims of substantial burden. I can imagine that courts may argue otherwise. Waiting a day or two does not prevent the abortion. What it does prevent, though, is for the poor to be able to shuttle themselves to, and this has been covered extensively ever since these things started, that a poor person has to travel 2 days or a day to go to the clinic, the one clinic in the state, like in Arkansas or Missouri. Why is there only one clinic? Because a campaign of terror and violence has been committed against those who run or work at clinics. You know, not just the pickets, but murder has been committed. Terrorism. What was it? George Tiller. Killed in front of his church. Because Bill O'Reilly and a bunch of other right-wing sickos called him the baby killer. That is why there's only one clinic. And thus you have to spend a day getting there, and then you have to wait 2 days. That means you need to pay for a hotel for 2 days. If you're poor, you can't do that. At the same time, if a court is willing to accept an abortion as a religious ritual akin to communion, then requiring people to wait several days before they are allowed to receive it should amount to a substantial burden. Of course, the Satanic Temple was careful to make clear that the abortion ritual was more than the abortion itself, strengthening its claim that the state's regulations interfered with the entirety of what they're calling the ritual. So what happens now? We wait for a challenge. If a Satanist seeks an abortion and is prevented from doing so in any meaningful way, the Satanic Temple could file a lawsuit saying the state is thus violating their members' religious freedom. It's kind of a bit of legal trolling, you see. You just go out with your strategy, you do a thing, and you wait for somebody to say, no, you can't do that. Then we wait for the fireworks. Anyway, as it said, the third tenet is like bodily autonomy, and the bodily autonomy argument, to me, is the strongest argument for abortion rights. An individual woman, has a right to control her body, just as she cannot be legally forced to donate a kidney. She should not be able to donate her body to the use of growing a fetus that she does not want to or does not have the ability to care for. This is from Newsweek. Funny thing on Facebook, someone called Newsweek Republican paper, like they were pro-Trump. But if you listen to my show, I've covered stories on Newsweek that were at least very least moderate, or at least didn't have a kind of point of view. But a neutral point of view can be very declarative and certainly not pro-Trump. From the opinion section, of course, and I think that's usually the case. Maybe it's the reporting that's kind of slanted in some way. The opinion section is all over the place, and sometimes it can be downright critical of the status quo. So I'm going blind again with this one. This is just an intro to the next story, by the way. So it's called Reading the News, You'd Think Democracy is Retreating Everywhere. Good news, the opposite is true. So let's see what she means by that. Written by Stephanie McNulty. Filed in January this year. India, the United Kingdom, Brazil, the United States. The major headlines in these countries conveys democracy in peril, democratic backsliding, or populist threats to democracy. However, other democratic transformation occurring around the world lacks the same spotlight, the spread of participatory democracy. That's my program. Modern participatory democracy is about empowering all members of a political system to make decisions about issues that affect their lives on a regular basis, not just during electoral periods. And that is the true, well, to me, true Achilles heel, or rather the argument against the liberal democracy, that you're foregoing your autonomy and political power by appointing one person to represent you in all matters. Let's assume that they will manage the affairs of state properly and do more, apparently, than just provide money for poor projects. That no one really likes it, but it's the best we've got. But there is something better. Direct democracy, participatory democracy. So the slow, discreet spread of this to almost every country in the world should give us hope. After decades of experiments, participatory democratic institutions in many ways deepen democracy by giving more power to more people. At the same time, there is no panacea. The complexities of policies demand multiple approaches rooted in clear goals and a commitment of values. that involved the existence and improvement of both representation and participatory democratic institutions. So this writer suggests that, you know, we can have both or both work together. Interesting hypothesis there. Obviously, many of us are not willing to give up representation. Going to direct democracy kind of means like, oh, I have to go to meetings or I have to like pay attention to things and vote regularly, not just once or twice a year. But there's also maybe participatory. See, when you put participatory democracy, it means you have to participate. If you use term direct democracy like I do, that means there's a lot more flexibility in the different kind of mechanisms that are in there. For example, proxies. You can still give someone your vote as a proxy, and then you can kind of have super voters where, let's say, someone has become proxy for 10 people, you know, because they trust them. So instead of having to rely on whoever runs for office and thus has the resources and social network to do so, the constraints for running for office are quite large, despite that, oh, anyone can do it. Yes, but to win, it's generally accepted. You need the ability to fundraise, the ability to, and it's all just kind of like marketplace of ideas, ideology of like, well, if you have the best ideas and your best personality, then people will hand over their money to you. Who will hand over money? Who has the ability to donate willy-nilly to political campaigns? It's not the poor. But anyway, proxy voting is an interesting part. Anyway, such institutions exist in nearly every country in both electoral democracies and authoritarian regimes. Not flashy, they consist of meetings and planning sessions to develop and vote on ideas about roads, bridges, parks, and sidewalks. Meat and potato stuff. Mostly local and state governments set them up, so they don't make national headlines. They provide space for citizens to come together, talk about how to improve their communities, and make collective decisions about how to move forward. So this isn't really referring to any big emotional, revolutionary or radical movement or policy. This is something actually a lot of Democratic mayors have been doing, mostly through public pressure. People ask for a process for public input, so they provide it. And so public input, like there's a ladder of participation where maybe the meetings are just consultative. So maybe you don't really leave feeling empowered because you're just telling the experts what you want and maybe they'll include it in the plan. Other better sessions would be you are making the plan and the experts are maybe just tweaking it later with their knowledge and so on and so on. And sometimes like the experts create the proposals, and then at the meeting, you are kind of voting on them. And whatever have the most votes gets the grant money. That's what we were doing here locally. Doesn't also feel empowering because it's, well, maybe there's enough choices, but then it's also a matter of who shows up. And who shows up are also other professionals. So certain priorities are given, certain projects are given priority. And that can feel pretty disempowering to me, where it's like, well, where's the stuff for poor people? You know, like, oh, the art school and the, you know. Most of these efforts took place in cities and towns. Local governments offered a sweet spot for engaging citizens and offering a venue for more deliberative policy making. One of the best known examples of this trend is the Workers' Party participatory budgeting experiment in Porto Alegre. I know very much about this. And this is in Brazil. In the late 80s, local government officials worked with activists to set up a budgeting process that was open for debate by the city's residents. Once the international community highlighted this as a successful democratic innovation, the process had become celebrated, and this I noticed it, and quickly spread across the country and then the globe. Today, an estimated 11,000 cities worldwide conduct some form of budget making annually. So I think there's like 5 cities in California that do it. The simplest form it takes is you put aside like $10,000 or you do some kind of little tax, raises $10,000, and that money is your participatory budget. So you have like, oh, we have $10,000. How do you want to spend it? Let's give $1,000 to each ward. And it's not a lot, but it's something. And you basically have a vote on election day with election day for projects that are proposed and worked out with city experts. So again, expertise is still valued. You still have that professional kind of twinge to it. professionalized. Usually other professionals take part, you know, middle-class people who are active already, have the free time, retirees, so they kind of get that kind of age bias. But, you know, there was a case of kids proposing stuff, and that's voted on. Whoever wins, or the top three winners of the vote, get the funding in New York, rather in our country. That's how it's usually done. It's part of the budget, like a line item of the budget. So it's not like in Porto Alegre, it was like 40% of the entire city budget. So like the actual spending priorities were decided by massive public meetings of hundreds of people. Several models of participatory democratic institutions do exist. There's citizen councils in Chile and Rwanda that engage people in decision-making about public policies. India's village councils invite residents to deliberate regularly. And Colombia national council system aggregates and approves community development policies. This is also the socialism that exists in Venezuela. You have entire neighborhoods that are like big communes. They are given a budget by the state, and then they decide how to spend it. Oh, we're going to build housing with it. We're going to build a school. Another built a community media center like this one, but better. Because we have to fundraise ourselves. We don't get any state monies. Decades later, has participatory democratic institutions deepened? Can they chip away at the anti-democratic structures rooted in centuries of colonialism, inequality, corruption, clientelism, meaning patronage politics, and discrimination? Persistent bad news about democracy suggests they have not, but scholarship on these experiences tells a different story. A large set of research docs evaluates the effectiveness of these experiments. A great deal of variation exists in the context and the outcomes, but there are several takeaways. First, that these institutions proved they are an important way to educate and engage citizens, you know, to break the processes of like, oh, people are stupid beasts and, you know, it's hopeless. People who just can't do it. No, if you give people a platform for empowerment, they can change over a few years. And it's like, oh, they are informed. They are interested in being informed. This station exists to do that. Participatory institutions can also improve citizens' quality of life. In Brazil, cities with successful institutions, participatory ones, spend more on education and have lower infant mortality rates. The most successful experiences need careful design processes. Leaders truly committed to citizen engagement, not just doing it for the sake of doing it or doing it because they're forced to. Citizen groups also have to be active enough to hold them to their promises. The recent book, Democracy from Above, explores the effectiveness of national laws that establish these institutions in Guatemala, Peru, and Bolivia. My research shows national laws do create ways for engaging citizens in local participation. At the same time, in countries plagued by authoritarian past, corruption, and clients, you know, patronage politics, these institutions can fall prey to the same problems as representative democratic institutions, serving as new institutional channels for exchange of goods, kickbacks, and paternalistic patterns. You know, I know better than you. But you can, you know, consult. I'll listen to you for a little bit. Advocates and reformers can design their institutions to reduce the potential for this co-option, exclusion, and corruption with processes that codify democratic values. If a team of government officials wants to improve quality of life in low-income areas, they must set rules to prioritize spending in those areas. If government teams are interested in ensuring that women and other historically, but they want to protect the marginalized, they can develop rules of engagement that ensures gender parity. I discussed how that can be turned around, like if it's based on gender parity, what happens to the non-conforming, the non-binary. Careful attention to these institutions' designs improves their effectiveness. Globally, these institutions are here to stay, can't be destroyed easily. The challenge is to improve these efforts and, of course, to make them in our own localities. The challenge is to improve these efforts to ensure the maximum number of people remain involved in these processes. So part of getting past the national crisis is kind of recognizing it for what it is and ignoring it. By ignoring it, I mean doing something else, not arguing incessantly about the national presidential election. But if we spent our time trying to get or getting these institutions built in our localities. Here in Albany, it was proposed, like participatory budgeting was brought up in when our new mayor was brought was elected, but it was shelved because it's expensive and we were basically starting austerity. So austerity kills this stuff. You know, the ability to actually raise a tax for the extra spending, or this dovetails very nicely with the BLM demands to defund the police and shift the money elsewhere. It's not cutting the police department. It's shifting money to community participation. They decide where the money goes. That's part of the demand of defund the police. So community control is probably the better slogan. I will be using it from now on, but of course defund is still there. But I know incessantly people complain about it. People who, where I would say, it's not up to you to decide what the slogan of the movement is. It's not your movement. But on the other hand, if the movement is to grow or to have the support of, say, these people. But again, it's like, you're just asking for permission at that point. Please, please, nice middle-class white person, please give me more autonomy and empowerment in the city I live in. Don't treat me like a child. You're not my parents.
Well, you know, your slogan is, you know, confusing.
Give me a break. Good, good, good. Okay, so the next one is election reform related. Rake choice voting. I don't know if I've explained it personally on this show, but there's plenty of videos, and it's actually being promoted in progressive circles quite well. It's a darling of the Green Party. We have been the ones pushing for this stuff. In Portland, but of course we do it in coalition, and that's how we actually get it done, but we're the ones kind of get the ball rolling. Local story in Portland isn't right related. Portland overwhelmingly approves expansion of ranked choice voting. This was filed back in March. Close to 80% of voters back the proposal to use ranked choice voting in all local elections. So this is, you know, better than before. Portland voters overwhelmingly decided Tuesday to expand the use of ranked choice voting to all city council and school board races. The proposal passed with 81% of the votes cast in all 12 precincts. That's close to 20,000 for, close to a little under 5,000 against. The voting method has been used to elect the city's mayor since 2011 and was used last year for the first time to decide state legislative and gubernatorial primaries. I'm glad to see Portland voters continue to support the expansion of ranked choice voting by large margins, says Anna Keller, spokesperson for Fair Elections Portland. She said in a written statement, Portland was the first city in Maine. Oh, right, this is Portland, Maine, not Portland, Oregon. Portland, Maine. Because in Maine, they have ranked choice voting statewide for federal elections, but there have been numerous court challenges to ranked choice voting for state offices. Can you guess which party? If you say one or the other, you're wrong. It's both of them. But particularly the Republicans. But the Democrats don't like it either. It was through a coalition of the Green Party and a bunch of others like this Fair Elections Portland that this has been able to be done. And of course, it's popular and people like it. Because it does say it gets rid of the spoiler effect, if it ever existed, but it also makes it so that, you know, the winner does in fact have to win a plurality of people's support. Okay, yes, Portland was the first city in Maine to use ranked choice voting, and now we can finally say that all of our elected officials will represent the choice of a majority of voters. This is a good day for democracy in Portland. In a ranked choice election, voters rank the candidates in order of preference. Here's the boilerplate explanation. If no candidate gets more than 50% of first choice votes, the last place candidate is eliminated, with their votes being redistributed to all their other candidates based on the second or third choices. The instant runoff process continues until one candidate gets more than 50%. In Portland, so thus, it also kind of gets rid of the defensive voting characteristics of, look, I'm not voting for him, I'm voting against him. The method of voting ensures that the winner is chosen by a majority of people. Now, of course, just because everyone voted for it, you know, 80%, doesn't mean that the people currently in charge will implement it properly. I think they will, they fight it in their own way by saying it's going to be confusing, and then they sabotage voting, or they make it the ballot more confusing than it needs to be. Like kind of the butterflies of the 2000 election, something like that. You know, you can finagle it. You can mess it up. Just like with the primaries, Democratic primaries this year. He just makes it up. And same with Trump in the general election. He's messing it up. He's screwing with the post office system. So mail-in ballots, you know, he says it's going to be a disaster. He can make it a disaster. It can be self-fulfilling. But of course, it's all quite a show, and it's quite terrible. Makes you want to have nothing to do with it, right? Last year, five candidates sought an open seat representing District 3 on the city council. Tai Chong won decisively without earning majority, although he did earn 43% of the vote in the first in the five-way race. Yeah, so here's the thing where, like, he didn't win a majority of votes. He got 43%, but because it was a five-way race, he had the most. And that's called first past the post. It doesn't matter if you actually have a majority of support of the population. You got more votes. And this is the thing with, like, even when it's just two candidates, red and blue, that you win, let's say you win with 51%. That means 49% didn't get their choice. Are they not represented? Now, usually if they're a bipartisan, fair-minded representative, they're going to say, look, I was elected by my base, but I'm here to represent the entire district. And so I need to work with my Republican brothers. And then it becomes a wash. Like, well, what was the point of voting for you then? And that's how any Democrat should feel these days. Unless they're in a spot where it's a Democratic socialist running or a DSA candidate or progressive, you know, right? So they're somewhat more less amenable to giving ground to our opponents. It's unclear what impact ranked choice voting would have had in that race or a three-way race for a large seat in 2017. Incumbent Jill Dudson edged out two more progressive candidates, earning 44% of the vote. The campaign for expanded ranked choice voting was relatively low-key. The most recent campaign finance filing for Fair Elections Portland says the group had nearly $4,000 to invest in the campaign, so that's all they spent. No group had registered as a ballot question committee or political action committee to oppose the initiative, but the main Republican Party is continuing to challenge the practice. Democrat Jared Golden unseated Republican U.S. Rep. Bruce Pulliden in a ranked choice election 2 years ago in the 2nd District. Poliquin came in first after the initial count, but Golden earned a majority of votes as the second and third place votes of two independent challengers were reallocated. The result withstood a federal legal challenge 2018. The main Republican Party announced on February 4th, so it is mostly them, I suppose. Democrats can announce on February 4th that it had launched a petition drive to put a question on the November's ballot asking voters to repeal the law that extends ranked choice voting to presidential elections. We have a green candidate for a Senate race in Maine, by the way, replacing Susan Collins, I think. And she is now invited. She's on the debate stage. That's good news. Her name is Lisa Savage. I've donated to her. And because of ranked choice ballot, she has a shot. She has more of a shot than any Green probably ever has for federal office. And that's just the long slog that we have to go through to win ranked choice ballot, win public financing so that we can actually fund our campaigns on small dollar donations without having the star power of Bernie Sanders. I think it's rather funny that you have other progressives, such as Justice Democrats, for example, saying, like, we can repeat the Bernie Sanders strategy for all our candidates. We can fundraise immensely for them. No. Like, Sanders was a national campaign with a national stage and national celebrity. You're not going to replicate that for this congressional candidate or not. So if that repeal effort fails, ranked choice voting would be used in the presidential primaries and general election beginning in 2024. So not this cycle. But let's just say that I expect that in 4 years or 8 years, Republicans like Kasich will be the new Democratic moderates. That will be the party. Democrats are the new Republicans. Republicans are the new fascists. So if you're progressive, you should join the Green Party. But see, the Green Party is now explicitly socialist or anti-capitalist. So if you are a social democrat, you know, they hem and haw about, like, well, they don't say the Greens are too far left for them. They just say the Greens, they make a bunch of other excuses, like our brand is damaged. Well, for most of America, our brand doesn't even exist. They don't even know we exist. So to say it's damaged, it's damaged maybe in professional beltway circles, but of course they would hate us either way. We're anti-war. And we pass and we fight for ranked choice ballots, which can upend their nice little, you don't want the other guy to win, do you, kind of system. So I think I will go over these three kind of unionization stories. Or maybe I'll drop this one. I'll do these two. This one's from the Sacramento Bee. Capital Alert. This was filed February of this year. California's newest union, child care workers, turn in their petitions. Child care workers delivered 10,000 union cards to the state Public Employment Relations Board to qualify for an election after a rally Wednesday at the Capitol. We're here delivering 10,000 votes for child care providers across the state in support of the election of our union, said family care provider Razine Reese. Assemblywoman Monique Limon, Democrat of Goleta, paved the way for some 40,000 child care workers to unionize and collectively bargain with the state last year through her Assembly Bill 378. Let's see. As far as movement workers go, Assemblywoman Monique is kind of what we'd call a champion. Someone on the inside who is an ally and willing to write the law to allow us to actually kind of do what we want to do, to be an effective movement. Because in our current context, without the right law, allowing you to legally challenge things or to codify the work you do, it's not, it's like it doesn't even exist. Like the city can't bargain with you. You can't actually negotiate with the powers that be. You're a nothing unless you have standing. And so you have to have a champion to legislate that you have standing, or you create your own religion so that you have standing, you know. Otherwise, you basically, you're an insurrectionist, you know, you're waging a guerrilla war of sorts, even if it's with nonviolent things, like projects, guerrilla gardening, for example, not unsanctioned activism, which can be easily overturned, or then you're fighting police and landlords because the law is not on your side. So it's not like you need the law on your side, you just at least need it to step aside. And for that, you need standing, you need to be granted rights, otherwise you don't have such rights. Default is you don't have rights. And that's what's, I think, insane about constitutional governance, is that, like, you have to fight for every inch of recognition. Otherwise, you don't have any. Here's another small unionization story, but this time from Kickstarter. Kickstarter has unionized, becoming the first tech company to do so as workers unionize across the industry. This is also happening in some gaming, game developers, and other such things. It's growing. Slowly, but it's revving up, and I've covered that before. This is from Business Insider. Kickstarter employees have officially unionized after a vote was tallied Tuesday, marking the first full-time workers at a tech company to do so as more across the industry look to organize. The historic 46-37, that's pretty close, vote in favor of unionizing comes after a contentious process, which involved the firing of two Kickstarter employees who were leading the effort. Course they were. The employees then filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board, always a great help, which has yet to resolve. And that's what I mean. They never really resolve things, according to Vice. Quoting them, "We support and respect this decision, and we are proud of the fair and democratic process that got us here. We've worked hard over the last decade to build a different kind of company, one that measures success by how well it achieves its mission, helping to bring creative projects to life." This is the Kickstarter CEO talking. So he's on the back foot, you see. But you see, like, oh, he respects the decision of the vote, but not enough to not fire the organizers. Shows his true colors. Kickstarter employees announced their union drive publicly last March under the name Kickstarter United, in the same day that co-founder Perry Chen resigned. Chen had a history of turmoil at the company. He left the company in 2013, but reassumed the CEO title in 2017. A year after his return, 50 of Kickstarter's 120 employees had left, and employees told BuzzFeed News that Chen's management style was the reason for it. Kickstarter had been dealing with tensions that employees said arose from Chen's heavy-handed management style, as well as internal disagreement over a decision to remove a project from the site after right-wing news site Breitbart claimed the project violated Kickstarter terms of service, according to Slate. Okay, so the Slate article is not just about that particular thing, but let's see how a Nazi-punching satire led to the first union drive at a well-known tech company, and workers say the firings of two organizers in 8 days. Okay, so the Slate article is just all the more details of this, since this is just Business Insider that just gives you the facts. Last September, Kickstarter filed Clarissa Redwine and Taylor Moore, two longtime employees who had been leading the union drive. CEO Hassan, that's the current CEO, wrote in a blog post that neither were fired for their organizing efforts. Oh, of course. No one's ever fired for union organizing. You can believe them. But also said that the union framework is inherently adversarial. It's true. That is true. But who's being adversarial first? You have managers. You have lack of workplace autonomy, the ability to manage your workplace. There's no democracy in a top-down pyramid corporate structure. Is that not adversarial? Is that not a lack of freedom? Is that not some form of light oppression, even if, say, you are choosing to work there? But you're not choosing to work. You need to work somewhere, and you need to not choose to have a good enough job to provide your basic needs. So why not have freedom there? It only helps everything. Let's see, Redwine's termination ultimately led her to file a complaint with the labor board. Employees have also accused the company of taking various steps to thwart their efforts to unionize. Probably why the vote was so close. So many people worked incredibly hard to earn Kickstarter's employees a seat at the table, and now they have one. Kickstarter is now a place for collective action through and through, Redwine said. Redwine's one of the organizers. She said this on Twitter after the vote was announced Tuesday, adding that the vote was close. Management did a great job busting. While Kickstarter United is the first union of full-time white-collar employees at a major tech company, workers across the industry have been ramping up their efforts over the past several years. Here's some other examples. Over 2,000 cafeteria workers at Google's Bay Area offices, so these aren't the tech bro programmers, these are the people who serve them in the cafeteria. They voted to join a union last December, and Google contract workers in Pittsburgh voted to unionize last August. While Chicago employees of the food delivery service Instacart also unionized earlier this month, according to Motherboard. Covered that extensively during the lockdown. Short of unionizing, workers at major tech companies have organized around issues such as controversial company policies. This is how it starts. Pay and benefit disparities. There was a recent article about at Blizzard Entertainment where workers were sharing their salaries in an Excel document chart to compare. They're talking about what they're being paid. Oh, you're being paid more than me? Why aren't we getting any raises? And so on. Questions are raised, and questions can lead to more questions. Like, maybe we should unionize. Thousands of Google, obviously management is not listening to us. Thousands of Google workers staged a walkout in 2018 over the company's record on sexual misconduct, while others protested last year after Google's fired several employees involved in organizing efforts as tensions within the company continue to simmer. Employees have also become more active in their company's decisions. Amazon workers spoke out about the company's impact on the environment, and its warehouse employees striked last year during its busy Prime Day over working conditions, which, if you need a reminder, included not having bathroom breaks, and some warehouses didn't have water in there. Access to water, air conditioning, and other such things. People were getting heat stroke. People were getting killed. Not to mention the pandemic and the lack of actual transparency in who was positive. In recent months, Microsoft employees went as far as to resign over the company's work with Immigrant Customs and Enforcement, otherwise ICE. And that's the end of that story. So, and this is an example. Oh God, I'll just linger on this one. So the Microsoft employees resigned over the company's work with ICE. This is so good because so much of our media and our stories and status quo warrior stuff is like, well, someone else is going to do it. If we don't work with the jackboots, someone else will. Well, it's not going to be me. So these people were the principled ones, the ones with empathy and humanity. And that's the question when it comes to the kind of participatory processes that are kind of from the top down. If the status quo is giving you this kind of process, is it legitimate? Is it really yours? Is it really your participation? Or are you not just giving it the system, your consent and support by taking part? And this is the kind of question that occurs over and over again when it comes to insider versus outsider strategy. Even though progressives get nothing from being Democratic Party members, what else can they do? Well, how else can they get any kind of concessions policy or even be part of the national conversation? And these are questions that have answers. I try my best to provide reasonable answers that don't resort to just kind of saying burn it down or you can't. You're always going to be co-opted. But that's kind of what it comes down to. You're always going to be co-opted. And that was the message of the participatory democracy thing, where it's like, well, it does come from the top down, when it is the powers that be that legislate your consultative process, it's going to suffer from the same structural failures, the same cronyism as before. Just with a little bit more listening, but maybe not. And the same goes for the nice CEOs, the nice corporate managers. They listen to you. Oh, they make you feel listened to. But at the end of the day, they still control your income. And collective action and saying no collectively is the ability to do that. No, we're not going to follow your rules. We're going to make our own rules. And our own rules are going to be more ethical. And they're going to be community-based. Yeah. Here's actually an example, a great segue, actually. So this is from Business Tech. No idea who funds them, but again, when news is free, it means that someone's paying for it. Someone rich. But here's the story. It's friendly for anarchists, too. High court rules private citizens can fix roads, then charge the government for it. I don't think I've read this one in particular. It's filed by Ryan Brothwell. This is from 2017, so it came up in a, I guess, an anarchist thread on Facebook. Probably not America. Funny, it's not even giving a country. I believe it's this takes place in Africa. But Africa's a big place, and I'm not going to... Okay, let's assume this is South Africa. The country. A recent high court decision has likely set a new precedent that could allow for private citizens and bodies... and community groups, to perform basic service delivery functions with taxpayer money. In the judgment, the Eastern Cape High Court ordered the Provincial Roads Department to reimburse farmers who carry out maintenance themselves, subject to strict conditions, including giving the department a month notice of the repairs and obtaining at least two independent quotes. Okay, so they're not like fixing it personally, like with their own hands. They're going to pay someone else to fix the road. And then they can ask for reimbursement. Or they can ask for reimbursement and get it if they tell the government, the roads department, that they're doing it. At the time of the judgment, president of Agra Eastern Cape, Douglas Stein, told the Eastern Cape paper Dispatch that the ruling would likely to have far-reaching consequences around the country as other farmers and civil society groups will follow suit. This was confirmed by civil group Afroforum, who noted that it was subsequently begun using some legal means to provide basic service delivery functions around the country. Speaking on the 12th of March edition of the report, head of Afroforum's local governance division, Marcus Paulson, noted that it had not only been reimbursed for roads, but other basic services such as removal of trees and the replacement of water pumps. The report also noted that Paulson and Afroforum announced plans to use their judgment to set precedent in other provincial jurisdictions so that people would not have to be reimbursed on a case-by-case basis, but could then implement the fixes using specific legal guidelines. So it would actually be codified, and there'd be a process for doing so, which is better than kind of in America, we have the public-private partnership, which is kind of the... See, what happens with public-private partnerships is sometimes it's like a company, and sometimes it's a nonprofit. And sometimes a nonprofit is funded by a foundation that is then a billionaire or millionaire. So it's like, what's the difference? It's just the charity arm. So much could be said about public-private partnerships. I don't know if I've yet fully explored the problems with them, but they're basically a tool of neoliberalism of private entities getting their way, not community groups. Sometimes it is community groups. And again, but that's like the case by case. A community group has a an institution, they're an organization, and a city or the state kind of gives them money, make a deal on a case-by-case basis to fulfill public services because the state's not going to do it or the state doesn't want to or it wants to be seen as saving money. The government isn't doing it, so it's not tyranny. We're going to give money for other people to do it. People locally, people who are in the area. Okay, that's good in principle, right? It's more democratic. But what happens when all of those entities are private companies or people funded by private companies? But that's just how... That's just because it's in our capitalist system, right? South Africa is part of that. So, but in this case, it's farmers in rural areas. So that's quite a bit different, I assume that's the case. Usually public-private partnerships are like in urban renewal, gentrification, kind of stuff that usually benefits the well-off first and foremost. Okay, I've reached the end of the program. So, thank you for listening. This is the Three Left Show. I hope you had an enjoyable time listening to me ramble and jabberjaw. Hope it was informative and you had a little bit of fun with me as I went through the news jam. This is a Three Left Show with Dan Platt. I want to invite you to go to the website for the full archive of episodes, threelefts.news, www.threelefts.news. We are on Facebook. The Facebook page is the main way to share and get other people to see the show. Also have a Twitter in which I post all new episodes that are podcasted, also via majority of podcast apps. Yes, Spotify and Stitcher and Google Play and iTunes. All of them, mostly. You can access the Three Left Show podcast, which I should... Yes, I have released last week's episode. What else is the Patreon? Three Left Show. Just do a search, a Patreon page. Please donate or become a member there to support me materially. All money there will then be spent on activities involved with growing this station. You can also become a member of the station. We'll be starting a membership or pledge drive. I don't really like that language, but that's my personal opinion. Membership drive, become a member because the Patreon model is pretty much the future when it comes to supporting media that represents you. If I don't represent you, please send me a line and tell me how I don't and I'm wrong and everything I said is crazy today. I will never mind that. But please, if you have any ideas or stories you'd like me to cover in the show, please do. Okay, I'm going.